Neve Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly team at Neve's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit nevesolicitors.co.uk. Neve Solicitors, your complete legal solution.
Welcome to The Parents Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. I'm Lydia L. Corey.
And I'm Cathy Weston. Welcome to the show this evening. We are talking this evening about emotional resilience in our children, how to build it, how to help our children, protect them really from the challenges, I suppose, Lydia, that life will present.
And for somebody who doesn't really understand what resilience actually is, I know it's a word that's been used quite a lot in relation to children and children's well-being, but what exactly is it? We all know what a resilient person is, but we're going to get to the bottom of what it is in relation to children.
That's right. I think we're all aware of what children need to be resilient about, because we understand the sort of the nature of childhood these days. We understand some of the pressures they're under, but we're going to try and unpick how we can actually help. What can we do at home to help build up a sense of self-esteem and things that can protect children and help them be resilient against those sort of challenges. Now, we're luckily because we're joined by great people tonight. So we've got Emma Judge from How to Thrive in the studio. She's the co-founder and lead trainer from an organisation called How to Thrive. You can look it up while we're on air. Great. They're doing fantastic stuff. And one of their flagship programmes is called the Pen Resilience Programme. Is that right, Emma?
That's right.
So we'll be talking to you about that programme. But we'll also be joined we'll be speaking to Fiona Brooke, who is the Professor of Adolescent and Child Health, and Joe Maher from Vista St Albans. And we'll be hearing as well from some people, a teacher and some pupils in a local Hertfordshire school who've actually been benefiting from the programme that How to Thrive have actually produced. So that's a bit action-packed.
Great. So let's kick off with Emma and let's ask you the most important question about this whole show. We've called it resilience. What exactly is resilience?
Well, that's a very good question. I think there's a number of different ways of thinking about it. So one way to think about resilience is as an inoculation, if you like, against a mental illness, against particularly depression and anxiety. So a lot of the work that goes on in schools and in government is to try and help bring down, if you like, the rates of anxiety and depression that we're beginning to see in young people. So that is definitely an important aspect of resilience. But I also think there's another aspect of resilience, which is much more about just coping with life, you know, with the everyday setbacks, the
pressures.
Just the normal stuff that happens in life and the kind of everyday muddling through. And I think with young people, it's about helping them not just cope with failure, but to embrace failure, to get something out of it, to feel okay about it, and to kind of grow and learn from it, as opposed to just cope.
And I think, you know, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, all of us, no matter what age our children are, they will come home from school upset or sad one day because someone hasn't sat beside them at lunch, or maybe they've asked a girl out and they don't want to go out with them. It's just the age range. We're talking about as a parent dealing with these issues the whole way through their school career.
Yeah.
So as you say, it's about that, you know, as early as we can actually get these, as a parent, this sort of knowledge base and an idea of how we can help them, the better.
Yes, and I don't think it's about avoiding being upset or angry or, you know, confused or anxious. I think it's about learning how to deal with that in a way that's helpful to them and in a way that doesn't lead them into kind of unhelpful thinking patterns that then get them into trouble in terms of their mental health. So I think one of the most important things about resilience to me is it's not about avoiding all bad things, because A, you can't do that, and B, we learn a lot from these things as we grow up, and it's important that kids actually in some ways are encouraged to take risks and to fail at things and get things wrong and make mistakes, and to learn that actually that's okay and they can come through that those experiences stronger and better.
I'd say that's a massive relief to parents out there to hear what you're saying, Emma. You know, like, everybody thinks your kid has to be happy all the time, you know, self-confident, believe in themselves. But that's just not how life is. I mean, none of us are like that. We all have moods. We have good moods, bad moods. And, you know, we have to learn to kind of understand that it's all right for our kids to go through that too. But like you say, it's giving them the coping mechanisms when they do face failure or rejection or sadness or anything, how to get through that.
It's interesting, the teachers that we work with, one of the things they tell us is that when they are having these conversations with kids, what kids love is when the teachers tell them about some of their experiences and how they don't always get things right and how they're having a bad day and they had a, you know, an argument in the staff room or whatever it might be, because it actually gives them permission to be making mistakes as well. And I think there's a danger in setting up young people to feel that everybody else is fine and everybody else is happy and perfect, and it's really, if you're not, then that's something wrong with you. So for me, resilience is just as much about the vulnerability and the kind of, I call it the everyday, the muddling through of life, not perfect people who can cope with anything that, you know, that the world may throw at them and act like Superman or Superwoman the whole time. That to me isn't resilience.
I think you've made me think as well that there's an important role for parents to sort of model resilience. You know, so if you're having a bad day, don't just put on a brave face, but you can say to your children, you know, gosh, I'm having a bad day, but I'm going to be all right, or whatever the resilient response might be.
Yes, I think modelling is incredibly important in all adults, actually. Teachers and parents are probably the two key groups of people that can do that. But you're right, modelling that life isn't perfect and modelling that that's okay and we get through it, and showing how we do that.
Well, would you like to tell us a little bit more about this exciting programme that is in, I think it's in 22 of our schools at the moment
in Hertfordshire? Yes, and it's in about 120 around the country. So we've trained about 450 teachers now. So it's basically a curriculum. It's an 18-week programme, and we teach children in any year from year 5 to year 7. And it's a programme that focuses on skills, on thinking skills. So it takes the cognitive behavioural model, which is well known and well used in medical terms. But it takes a very non-therapeutic approach. So this isn't therapy. This is about giving kids life skills that they can use to cope with all sorts of different situations. And fundamentally what it does is it helps young people learn to firstly slow down, to take a moment, take a breath, figure out what's really going on as opposed to what they think is going on inside their head, recognise that what they're thinking may not be helping them, and then decide what they want to do next. So that's really what we're doing with these young people, is giving them the chance to take some control of situations as opposed to reacting to a situation and then stepping back and thinking, oops, wish I'd done something different there.
Can I go on one, please? I think every parent would love a resilience program. That is fantastic to think that those kind of life skills are being taught to teachers to help our kids learn the same thing. It's fantastic. Is it a separate class within the curriculum, or is it just teachers are being equipped with these skills while they're teaching other things?
It is a separate class. It tends to be taught in what life skills or PHSE, whatever schools call that bit of the curriculum. That's what most schools do. And what we do is train the teachers. So it's interesting, you know, when you say, can I have a bit of this? The way that we do the training with the teachers is we spend 5 days with these teachers, and most of them tell us that's more training they've had on almost any topic since they trained to be teachers. And of those 5 days, we spend 3 days with them working on their resilience and giving them the skills. And then we talk about how they can teach it to young people. And that's the modelling point you were making earlier, because if they're using the skills and they've tried them out and they're using them and they're working in their own lives, they then tell those stories to the young people. And that's where a lot of the learning happens, is in those stories. So the teachers, I think they would say, get quite a lot out of it as people and as parents themselves,
and
often.
What is the feedback like? I mean, what do they say anecdotally? What do you hear from them?
Well, we evaluate every programme, and we do get very strong feedback. I think teachers find it very useful professionally and personally. And they're quite surprised, I think, that they find it so useful personally. They don't expect that when they arrive. They think they're just there to learn something for their kids, and they're very passionate about that. What they come to realise that it's actually useful in their own lives too.
And I think what I was very impressed by, maybe you're too modest to say, Emma, but LSE, obviously a very highly respected university, does an ongoing evaluation of this programme. And they, I think one of the things I read is that they said it participation on the programme led to lower depression rates, better attainment, less anxiety in children. just from the sort of participation, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So the programme was initially designed as an inoculation against depression and anxiety, so nearly 20 years ago. But since then, it's become much more about life skills. So the outcomes you see for young people is a reduction in the risk of depression and anxiety. We can't promise that no young person that experiences this programme will ever experience depression and anxiety. That would be amazing. But, you know, we are reducing the risk of that happening. And we are also seeing all sorts of other impacts, such as behaviour, attainment, just better relationships. Parents notice a difference in their children. Schools who've been running this programme for 5 years, what they notice now is they'll have a whole community who have been through the same experience and have a shared language and can sort of talk about things in a particular way. And that can be very helpful.
So it's actually impacting on school culture.
Definitely.
Ultimately.
Yeah.
Can you give us a kind of a more concrete example of one of the outcomes of it? Emma, I know I'm just trying to translate it into everyday.
What does it look like?
What does it look like?
Yeah.
What are the life skills? Could you touch on that?
So the main skill that we teach is called the ABC skill. And the ABC skill suggests that in life, things happen. The A is the activating event. So something happens. It doesn't always have to be a bad thing, but it might be. You might be late. You might be late for a meeting, say, as an adult. And traditionally, we tend to think that something happens and we react to that thing, and that's the C, the consequence. But in reality, what's actually happening is that between the activating event and the consequence, there are a set of beliefs. So anything that happens, we interpret that thing, and then we respond to our interpretation.
So my friend hasn't shown up for lunch. She hates me. I'm ugly.
Exactly.
Not popular.
Yes, and the consequence of that is that you feel very sad and you withdraw, and then chances are when your friend does come and talk to you, you don't respond very helpfully, and then maybe you do end up having a friendship issue when you needn't have done so in the first place. So, you know, it's helping young kids recognise that it's not actually the situation that decides how they respond, it's their thinking, and that that's where they can have some control. So we really encourage kids, as I said at the very beginning, to slow right down, to recognise what we call their internal radio station, to listen to it, to decide whether that's an accurate view of the situation or not, and then to decide what to do next, as opposed to just kind of reacting.
Invaluable. I just think that'd be fantastic. What age group does a kind of programme start from too? Sorry if you said that already.
Any age, the age at which a young person can think about their thinking, that's the critical thing. They've got to be able to listen to that internal radio station. So really from year 5 onwards, which is what, kind of 9, 10, mm-hmm. through to about year 8, it's a very useful programme to do around the transition between primary and secondary school, because a lot's going on for young people then, and on many levels, particularly around friendships, relationships in the family, and the pressure of schoolwork.
Absolutely. Well, listen, luckily, something we did earlier was visit a local school that was in Monk's Walk in Welland. It was actually in the middle of delivering your programme, and we spoke to the teacher there and some of the children.
Now, I'm at Monk's Walk School in Welland, and I'm joined by 2 Year 8 students, Anna and Patsy. Hi, guys. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
And Miss Mitchinson, who you are currently the teacher, the PSHE teacher, so that means that you're involved in actually delivering this programme called the PEN Resilience Programme.
Yeah, I am.
Now, tell us, PEN Resilience, what does PEN stands for? Pennsylvania, is that correct?
It does. The programme was started as a result of a study done in Pennsylvania University that showed that there was a real need for young people to become more resilient. They weren't particularly good at dealing with life's everyday problems.
And so this is a programme you have been helping deliver in the school for how long?
We started it in last September, so we're just starting our second cohort now. So all of our Year 7s and all of our Year 8s have either done the PEN Resilience programme or are currently in line to start it in January.
And we're just saying, you know, this isn't an ordinary programme, is it? It's an extremely lengthy and extensive one. Tell us a little bit, I know it's very detailed, but tell us a little bit in summary about what the programme provides.
It's run in 2 sections. It's an 18-week programme. The students study an hour a week. You have to go through a significant amount of training to actually be able to run it. The first 8 weeks are looking at the problems that arise. So the first 8 weeks is all about linking the activating events, so something that happens, with what thoughts that is generating for you, and how the thoughts then are going to affect your consequences. So, for example, a student forgets their PE kit and thinks, I'm in trouble now. And that is then what brings them to look really sad when they enter the PE changing rooms. If we can identify for the students what that thought is, we can then get them to understand how they're acting. So we look at that. We look at the fact that some people are naturally pessimistic and some people are naturally optimistic, and that can affect how you're going to react to something. That isn't necessarily something we can change, but it's something they need to be aware of as they move on. We look at the fact that everybody's different, so students can face the same dilemma but react completely differently because of everything they bring into it. We look a lot at worst case scenarios. What is it that they're most afraid of? What's the best case scenario? And then we ask them to identify what's most likely to occur. And in doing that exercise, they tend to realise that the most likely is okay, really, in comparison. And then as the programme develops, we look at how to actually help the students through relaxation. We look at visualising techniques. We look at a little bit of meditating, a little bit of yoga, just to mix it up so that the students actually have coping strategies to deal with the problems that we've identified earlier on.
And I'm sure, I mean, it just sounds fantastic. And I'm sure a lot of parents listening are thinking, well, gosh, shouldn't that happen anyway in school? Like, why does it need a specialist programme?
I think what happened is PSCHE programmes are very different in different schools, and that side of emotional well-being is very current. We're aware that students actually deal with problems that their parents didn't 20 years ago. And so actually it is a programme that they've invested very heavily in, that is backed on cognitive behavioural therapy, so it has its base in science and psychology, and it's relevant to our students now. It's a really exciting programme to deliver, because you see those little light bulb moments as a student realises that's why they feel like that.
Now, students in year 8 and 9, what age would they be?
The year 8s would be 12 and 13, and then the year 9s would be 13 and 14. We deliver ours in year 7, so as they arrive, 11 and 12.
And what is it about that particular age that you think demands the programme more than other ages?
I think it's that they're breaking away from their parents. They're realising that actually the world is really big, and sometimes they have to stand on their own two feet. And at that stage, some students don't manage so well, that they lack the confidence, they lack the sort of toolbox, if you like, to take out a coping strategy for a problem that's experiencing now. The secondary transition is really important for that.
And so you would think, if other schools were listening and they might be interested in the programme, would you recommend it for that transition year? Because I think obviously each school has a choice on in which year group to deliver it. Is that right?
Yeah, I think the transition year 7, is absolutely fantastic. I know some primary schools have tried to deliver it, and some primary schools do deliver it really quite well. But I think it's the emotional development that the students have in year 7 that makes it.
So it sort of has to be effective. It has to be matched by their emotional maturity.
Absolutely. They have to be able to understand the concepts that we're discussing.
And talking of maturity, I've got two very mature ladies here, Anna and Pat. Is that correct? Now, you guys, Patsy, was that correct, Patsy?
Yeah.
You feel free to correct me. You have been experiencing, if you like, the Penn Resilience Programme for how long? How long have you been doing it?
A year. Yeah, we did it from the start of year 7, and then we don't do any again. We carry on with the PSCHE.
And so we've just heard from Ms. Mitchinson about the content of the programme, the types of scenarios it helps you to deal with. Do you think it's helped you maybe consider your feelings in different situations that crop up in school?
Yeah. So if you had a situation, then you wouldn't like go straight into it. You would like think about it and go through the techniques that we've learnt in PRP and the situation.
And what might those sorts of situations be?
Like friendship issues at school.
Yes, you might walk in and suddenly your friend's not speaking to you, or they may not show up for lunch, that type of thing.
Yeah, and even though you're upset, you don't need to show it, you just need to think about it and like go back and see what's actually happened and like, yeah.
Yeah, so you might stop and think a little bit more about, as Ms. Mitchell says, you're not sure what's going through their head, what they've been experiencing. So does it take practice to do that, or is it coming more naturally now?
So now that we've learned in year 7, it's kind of easier, because now we've learned like different techniques and that we actually need to learn. It's like easier to like face a situation and sort it out.
And can you think of a situation, an example, Anna, where that's similar, where you've been faced with something that might be a bit more difficult and you do try and think about someone's feelings?
Like if you fall out with your friend and things, you sort of need to think of how they've, like, what's caused them or you to fall out with them, and like what's going on at home with them and things that would have caused it, not just how you're feeling there now.
So try and think a bit more broadly about the context of what's going on and not just focus on the little things. Now, girls, what strategies do you use to try and stay positive when things might be get a bit tricky in school?
I think when we did PRP, it was quite good, the visualising relaxation, because it helps you sort of calm yourself down before you sort of like quickly go out and blast a load of words out, and it sort of calms you out and makes you think how they're feeling and like what you're thinking and what actually is there.
And that relaxation technique or visualisation, I mean, it sounds very useful surely for exams and all sorts of situations, not just, you know, people to people scenarios.
It is. We do a number of lessons where we're looking at, the aim is solving dilemmas, but if we can do that through imagery or through even distraction techniques, and we teach that there is a point at which the best thing to do is get up and walk out for that moment, that rather than say things that can't be unsaid, in that moment maybe the best thing is to leave the situation and then deal with it later when everyone's calmer and there isn't so much heat around the argument. And the thing is, it's not just about friendship issues in school. If we can teach that in the home so that they're actually able to practice those at home, we also teach things like assertiveness, that it is important that they can actually assert themselves without appearing rude and without being aggressive, but that their point is valuable and that they do need to share it. We teach all of that as well.
And do you find you're going home and telling your mum and dad to visualise and relax and giving them different ways of coping with situations?
Yeah, it helps.
Does
like
it?
To talk about it and stuff and relax about it,
And maybe it sounds like being able to have more challenging conversations, difficult conversations.
Yeah,
great. All nodding heads. That's great. Now, would you say, there's a very big word written down on my sheet here. Can you describe what catastrophizing is? Is that the correct pronunciation?
It is catastrophizing, yes.
Well, what on earth is that?
Catastrophizing is sort of where you, in a way, you over-exaggerate. So if you're, like, being told that your friend won't come to the cinema with you because they say they've got, like, to go somewhere with their family, if you sort of think, they don't like me anymore.
She doesn't like me. I remember all this. This is bringing back memories. Yeah.
Like, they don't want to be my friend anymore. That's sort of catastrophizing. Whereas you could just be like, maybe they actually do have a family problem or something. And maybe another time.
Overthinking the situation.
And sort of getting very, very stressed. It's very easy to get stressed thinking through the same issue, isn't it? And getting stuck on that. Brilliant. And would you say that the Penn Resilience Programme has helped you guys become more resilient?
Yeah, it sort of helped you think of other people's views and how you can achieve a better friendship.
Start to think of the first thought that you have and think of, like, ways to go around it.
And we've just chatted about being assertive. Young people need to be confident, have those life skills. Is it difficult to learn how to be assertive as opposed to aggressive or being seen as aggressive?
It is a little bit, yeah, but, like, but the PRP program has helped to try and see the difference between them and be more, like, good.
Great. So thank you very much, Kathy, for talking to
Monk's Walk School in Welland.
Yeah.
And just to thank the ladies there, the fantastic teacher, Jo Mitchinson. I hope she's listening. Thank you very much for that contribution also to the Year 8 students. Now back to you, Emma. We've just heard from Monk's Walk. So we've got a sort of a good idea now of how the Resilience Programme works. But how can schools get involved, or how can parents promote it to their own children's schools?
Well, I guess a little bit of parent power wouldn't go amiss. I think, a lot of secondary schools in Hertfordshire are already involved. And as a county, I have to say it's been one of the most committed to this area that we have across the whole country. So
that's great news for us.
Yeah, exactly. I do think they deserve some praise for their long-term thinking on this. They've been working working with us for 6 or 7 years now.
Brilliant.
But if your school isn't involved, then I would say go and talk to your head teacher, to your governors, and ask the question and see what the strategy is. And is the school thinking about well-being and emotional resilience in the school? They may be doing it in other ways, and there are lots of other ways out there that are
and
good.
And if so, signpost them to howtothrive.org.
That would be great. Howtothrive.org.
Great. Yeah. Now, Lydia, another interview we did earlier in the week was with Fiona Brooks, who's the Professor of Adolescent and Child Health. She's going to talk to us now a little bit about the national picture of what children have to be resilient against and what parents can do.
Hi, Fiona. Welcome to the Parents Show. Now, Fiona, you are the Professor of Adolescent and Child Health at UH, and you've actually recently written a whole chapter on resilience for the Chief Medical Officer of England's annual report, which is fantastic. So it's great to have you with us. Tell us, what sort of issues are affecting children these days? You know, what sort of things do they have to be resilient about?
Right, well, in the past, we often thought of children as having sort of this notion of a carefree childhood. They climbed trees and whittled sticks and just had fun, and we didn't think much stressed them out. And now I think, and particularly parents, are becoming increasingly aware that children are facing a lot of stresses in their lives. There's greater pressure at primary school, right through to secondary school, in terms of exam and academic performance. And this stresses, you know, from SATs to GCSEs to early GCSEs to a whole exam system they have to get through, which is undergoing rapid change, which is also stressful. There's a greater level of risks out there that they have to navigate. You know, there's a wider range, for example, of things that might damage their health, such as from drugs, alcohol, cyberbullying, the internet, all sorts of things that I know parents are concerned about. And also, we're much more aware these days of, you know, the negative experiences of bullying. In the past, we said to children, oh, you know, shake hands, make up, toughen up, you know, get over it. And now we're aware that actually some of these things can have very damaging long-term outcomes for children. So I think parents are certainly more concerned and aware that children are facing more stresses.
And we hear about things like sexting in schools, all these new phenomena that we've never experienced ourselves as children. What would you say is of biggest concern to you that children are going through? Would it be the bullying, the cyberbullying?
Well, it's all part of the same. I mean, we know that children experience cyberbullying, experience other forms of bullying. So they're not, it's just an extension. But it can be more damaging because, or experienced in a more damaging way, because it's much more anonymous. So it's groups of people getting together and having what, from their perspective, may just be a laugh, but it's received by the person as a much more personal and anonymous attack as well.
And presumably the distribution of bullying material brings it to a whole new level. Because it only takes a second to send that email.
I think what parents need to be aware of is that children and adolescents are exploring behaviours, they're exploring what it is to be an adult and what the adult world around them is like, but they make mistakes within that. So here, that sexting, as you said, Kathy, is a really good example of a child who just makes a mistake. They send the wrong image to the wrong person and it suddenly goes viral. Whereas in the past, they might have done something like that with a small group and it's just forgotten about.
Yeah, or a picture goes up on Facebook and they have to cope with the aftermath of that.
Yeah, and I mean, my teenage years were not documented at all, thank goodness, and I'm sure you feel the same. So, and now it is, and it makes them much more vulnerable. And I think that's why we're seeing an increase over the decade in terms of sort of low-grade mental health issues amongst our young people. Sort of, you know, stressed, worried, anxious, all those kinds of, you know, not actually psychotic and psychosis and sort of mental illness, but sort of stressed
anxiety.
And anxiety, self-harm on the increase, all of that, I think, because of the levels of stress they're under.
And I have to say, self-harm has cropped up a lot in the press, but also locally. We've heard anecdotally quite a lot about self-harm in Hertfordshire schools and things. What would you say about that particular issue? Is that, again, a symptom of bullying particularly? Or?
It can be. It can also be linked. Like a lot of risk behaviours, if your young person is drinking a lot or you know, perhaps engaging in sort of dangerous kind of relationships, it's probably a symptom of, it's more likely to be a symptom of low self-esteem, low, poor body image, high levels of stress and anxiety, than them actually being a confident, outgoing one, you know, the, who you know, you might think be the person engaging in that kind of behaviour.
So obviously, as parents, we're desperate to prevent our children becoming anxious, although it's completely impossible to avoid it completely.
I mean, they're going to. I think the things that can be really helpful for parents is if you think they're going to be exposed to some of these behaviours, they're going to be exposed to alcohol, they're going to be exposed to the internet, the genie's out of the bottle and all of this. So how can you help them navigate that successfully?
And I think something you mentioned to me in the past was that if the parent isn't the credible source of information and help, the internet is.
Yes. So, or their friends are. Yeah. And they and friends can be really supportive and a really good resource for children and young people. But actually, all our research suggests that parents are the key figure in their life.
So in terms of what we can do to protect them, to make sure their self-esteem doesn't plummet, to help them navigate school life and life beyond that, what would you say, what approach is optimal, say, for parents to adopt? Yeah.
I think there are two things that can be really useful, and certainly the young people we talk to a lot in our research say this: listening and non-judgmental. So it can be really useful to talk to young people about, you know, what's happening around alcohol. If you say, don't drink, never drink, it's, you know, then they're going to hide it from you because they're going to go to parties where they're exposed to alcohol. So it's much better to say, how can you navigate that? How can you manage that? How can you just have one drink? Or, you know, how can you keep control? What are the danger zones? You know, when strangers are giving you, young people you don't know are giving you lots of drinks, or, you know, how can you manage that and kind of navigate that situation?
And presumably the same for drugs.
Exactly.
Because a lot of parents just don't want to think that their secondary school child would be offered drugs.
So it's really important that you talked about, because a lot of, I mean, the research has shown that a lot of young people end up taking things like heroin, not even knowing it's heroin.
Wow, so knowledge is power.
Because they're told to take, and they're given a name for it, and they don't even know that that's heroin, or that's a cocaine, or that's, or they're told it's a legal high. Right. So it's really worth just talking through some of these things with them and being open about it, saying, well, you know, what are your friends doing? And not being shocked, or just being a trustworthy source. Mm-hmm. Because all of our research shows that where parents are warm, supportive and listen to young people, then they navigate all of these things much more successfully.
So no matter what happens, they have the best possible chance of coping.
Yes, exactly. Because you've given them some strategies, and they know that if it goes wrong, you're not going to, you know, come down on them like a ton of bricks. Because actually, as they navigate, particularly into adolescence, the more punitive, disciplinary kind of approaches really, at the end of the day, do not work.
Okay.
I mean, you do need to set boundaries with young people. I'm just not saying no discipline, but that it is important to talk about autonomy and boundaries to around their autonomy.
And I think one lovely phrase that we spoke about earlier was negotiated autonomy.
Yes.
And I think that's
really,
a beautiful,
really
phrase. Can you just explain?
Well, as children, because we all have very good strategies for managing discipline and the boundaries when children are young, because it's quite easy to do that. To say, no, you can't go and play in that playground, you can't do this, you can't do that. But as children move through childhood and into adolescence, they're going to find ways to get round what your rules and regulations if you're completely rigid around it. But if you talk to them and you set boundaries and you negotiate their age-appropriate autonomy, so what can they do at a certain age, what can they do at the next age, what is a reasonable limit, and what to do if something goes wrong, knowing that you're a source of support.
I think something that concerns parents a lot would be sexual behaviour. Mm. And, you know, the common view is that perhaps children these days are having sex very, very early. A, is that true? And B, around that particular issue, parents may not be sure how to set boundaries or where to put the limit if they don't even haven't even thought through their own view on it. What would you say about early sexual experience like that and how it impacts on later mental health.
One thing to offer parents is a very strong reassurance that over the last decade, early sexual initiation has declined rapidly in this country. So much fewer young people are having sex early. But those young people who have a very healthy and a very healthy view around sexual behaviour and tend not to have sex very early are those whose parents have been very open and discursive with them around these issues. Brilliant. Which can mean taking a deep breath and answering some questions you don't want to answer or you find awkward, but actually being very open about it.
And obviously this doesn't just mean mum and dad, it means any principal carer.
Yes.
Granny, granddad, yeah. They all have to be in the same page, presumably.
Well, I mean, it's quite interesting. Our research actually also shows that girls in particular tend to have a very positive view of their body image. They tend to not engage in sexual activity very early. If they have a father figure, it needn't be their father, but a very good communication with a father figure. So a male in their life who has good communication with them tends to be protective for girls, which I think is quite interesting.
Very interesting. Yeah. What about boys now? I think boys often perhaps spend a lot more time in outside areas in play. Yes. They're encouraged to go out more, perhaps, and perhaps have maybe in some circumstances less boundaries attached to them. I don't know if you'd agree with that, but should there be a difference in how we parent boys around resilience?
I think safety on the street is a big issue for boys. And we know from our research that boys who feel that their communities are friendly and welcoming of young people actually are doing better than boys who are out on the street who feel vulnerable and don't feel safe. A lot of young people do not feel safe on the streets. We often think about, you know, young people causing trouble on the streets, but actually a lot of young people don't feel safe out there.
So where are they? The environment that they're in matters. The people they're hanging around with matters, but how they feel, if they feel safe physically.
Yes. But also I think our attitudes to young people on the street, being around, being out and about, are very different in this country to, say, countries which have very positive child wellbeing, such as the Netherlands or Sweden, where young people are viewed in a much less negative light overall.
How do we rate compared to these other countries? We always hear the Nordic countries are doing brilliantly. You know, where do we compare and how could we do better?
We could certainly do better around emotional wellbeing, so and protective health factors. So while we're doing pretty well and have really improved over the last decade in terms of risk behaviour, so the drugs, alcohol and things that parents often really worry about have dramatically improved. Regular drinking has dramatically gone down in this country. But where we were not scoring is positive health behaviour. So our girls are even of normal weight and much more likely to be ditching food and be on diets. They're not taking the amount of physical activity that promotes their health and well-being and may help them navigate stresses. We're lower than a lot of other countries around emotional well-being as well, just feeling less anxious.
And as you say, if parents had a few techniques or even just have open to that communication channels, open to having that, been able to answer those difficult questions, that's a step forward.
Yes, and all the research tends to suggest that the family and parent communication is key. Irrespective, we hear a lot about, you know, changes in family structure over the last decade and, you know, a lot more people growing up in single homes, lonely parent households. But actually what our research tends to show is that if communication is good within the home, that is more than compensates for any changes in family structure.
Radio Verma. Thank you very much for coming back to us on the Parents Show this evening. So thank you very much to Fiona Brooks for that fascinating interview about resilience. I think it was just, it's communication, isn't it, Kathy?
That's the central message, is that the way in which we communicate our children really matters.
Now, very importantly on that topic, we absolutely have to bring in our next guest who knows more about this on the ground than any of us. Jo Myers in the studio with us this evening. How are you, Jo?
I'm fine, thank you.
Now, what do you think about communication? Is that
It's absolutely key.
Is it?
It's not as easy as it sounds, particularly with adolescents as they grow up. But the key thing that we always help with parents is to keep communicating, even if you don't agree with what your child is saying. To keep the communication channels open is absolutely key. And I'm glad she mentioned a lot about feeling safe on the streets rather than just being safe, because I was here tonight to talk about protective behaviours, which is really fits in well with this resilience programmes that are being introduced in Hertfordshire. A lot of schools do what we call protective behaviours programmes, and this is much more about safety with children, that inner safety that they need, and feeling safe rather than being safe. You could have a playground where you've got fences as high as anything, you've got equipment that has been tested, you've got the adult-child ratio sorted out, but not every child is going to feel safe when they're in that playground. Protective behaviours is relevant for adults as well as children, so it's a great program. And we teach the children lots of strategies how to recognize their inner feelings. Again, it's going back to emotions, so that they recognize when they're feeling uncomfortable or unsafe in an unsafe situation and how to deal with it.
It's so important, isn't it, Joe? Yeah. I mean, we were talking about life skills earlier.
Yeah.
And that's exactly it. You're just giving them an invaluable life skill.
Yep. Some of it is just so basic and very, very simple. But you have to remember that children don't understand their own bodies necessarily and what their bodies are telling them. So I was running a session the other day and with little year threes and fours, and it's telling them, you know, if you feel unsafe somewhere, your body actually starts to tell you that, you know, your heart beats faster, your knees might begin to shake, you get butterflies in your tummy and things like that, you get sweaty hands, whatever. So we're teaching them to recognise their own feelings and then actually empowering them how to work with their feelings and what to do about it if they don't feel safe.
And how do you manage to educate them and equip them with those skills and not scare them at the same time? Because obviously you want them to be aware, but you don't want them to be terrified every time they go out on the street.
No. It's just we're not putting them in certain situations, we're just teaching them how to recognize these feelings and what to do about it. One of the main reasons behind it is obviously to help them avoid peer pressure. And as we know, peer pressure is something parents are very, very worried about. And we teach them, you go from feeling safe to having fun to be scared. You know, you might go on a roller coaster, you might watch a scary movie, you might sit in the dark. Then some children or adolescents take it one stage further where they risk on purpose. So they will deliberately put themselves in a little bit of danger. And then you get to the next stage where you don't feel safe. So there are some children who could be out on the streets with friends who start doing things which they think are fun. It's fun to do this. And these other ones don't. So we're teaching them, you have the power inside yourself to say no. You can stop yourself from having to do these things. Really, really important inner emotions, inner strength to keep yourself safe in whatever situation you're in.
That's just great. And you know, the great thing about it is to know that there are organisations like yours out there thinking these things through for our kids to keep them in, you know, keep their well-being where, you know, in the best, in the most positive way it can be.
Protective Behaviours is actually a website, and they have trained the staff in Hertfordshire. So we're just there as tools to cascade the information and hopefully get the schools to run with it and, you know, help the children in lots of ways. And then beyond, once you know that you're not feeling safe, we teach them to have a network of what we call the build a helping hand and you have a different friend or responsible person on each finger on your hand, a network of fingers, so that they go to them. I mean, we in businesses, we have networks, which are people you rely on and colleagues that you know. So we're teaching children to have their own networks. Sometimes that might be your auntie or your neighbour next door or the teacher, but you'll often find out that some children, those who are slightly more vulnerable, may not have enough people on their helping hand to go to. In that case, then you need to look after them a bit more, keep an eye on them.
Fantastic. Great advice, Joe, as always. Now, the Protective Behaviour website is on our Facebook page now. Thanks to Julie Dean out there, she's Facebooking away on the Parents Show Facebook page. So if you'd like to check out some of the comments out there, interact with us, we'd love to hear from you. We've already had one comment from, let me just find it there. Oh, where has it disappeared to?
Lewis Stockwell.
That's right, Lewis Stockwell, who was encouraging us to look at philosophy as the, he said, teach them philosophy, gaining knowledge about the world and an ability to articulate how they feel. Makes a lot of sense to me.
And I think that's what we've been talking about tonight, our thinking skills. Emma Judge was mentioning thinking first before you act. Yeah. And you're mentioning just the ability to recognise your feelings first.
Yeah, and then act on it. But how to have the strength or the confidence. It's all about confidence building. Yeah. So they actually do act, or they go and tell somebody, I'm not happy about this, I don't feel safe.
Or as you just mentioned, peer pressure, having the confidence to get out of a situation you're not comfortable in.
Yeah.
Jo, if parents are listening tonight and they've got a problem at the moment with one of their children, or their children has come home and something has happened and they're very distressed, or the parent needs advice, where do they look to locally? Who can they ring?
If it's about protective behaviours, we can help. We can help parents. We do run parenting programmes called Feeling Safe, Standing Strong. So if enough parents actually emailed Vista St Albans, it's vistastalbans@gmail.com, we could run a course if there was enough interest. Always ask at your school, because a lot of the school staff are aware of this program. They, you know, it's in an awful lot of schools. So they could go to their teacher, go to the head teacher, or come to us if it's more just on the parenting side of life.
And tell us again the website for Vista.
It's www.vistastalbans.org.uk.
Brilliant.
Great stuff.
We'd just like to say thank you to our guests tonight, Emma Judge from How to Thrive, Joe Mitchinson and the girls from Monk's Walk School in Welland, and Joe Marr from Vista St Albans. Have a very good evening. Thank you very much.
Neave Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly team at Neave's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit neavesolicitors.co.uk. Neave Solicitors, your complete legal solution.